Welcome, Chris, for my episode of Let's Tell Joe. Today the topic is the light industry innovations in the built environment. So I guess the questions are going to be focused on your industry. But let's give a little introduction. So Christian Willets-Krog, I hope I spelled right. Where are you from?
Denmark.
Denmark. Okay, yes. That sounds like Denmark. Yes. You're a serial entrepreneur. Your specifics on LinkedIn. From LinkedIn says you're a design management expert, industrial design, architectural light design, well-being in the built environment, which is something really interesting, which today I think it's so important that we managed to find well-being in the built environment. You're the founder of Crayol, which is the reason we met as well, somehow, for the breakfast with the entrepreneurs, and founder, partner, and director of Dynamic Environment Group, which I'm so curious on. This name sounds fantastic. and you're part of the Light Design Collective, yeah. and a lot more. But I guess, welcome, first of all.
Thank you so much for being here. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
So, yeah, I mean, first of all, I'm curious to know more about well-being in the built environment because, somehow, my family are into the well-being industry with organic food, with the, from my mother's side, they work more into hospitals but now, I'm studying planning and architecture and I'm very passionate about it. And so, yeah, I'm curious to know more about your idea of well-being in the built environment.
Okay, well, well-being in the built environment is a big topic, obviously, at the moment. It's one that's very much come to the fore of discussions. Up until this point, there's been a lot of talk, obviously, about energy reduction, efficiency in buildings, and so on and so forth, but the topic of how buildings are actually impacting us is something that's relatively new in the discussion. And so I suppose I got into that about little under 2 years ago, into that kind of into that discussion, but I realized by chance that it's something that's quite embedded in what we do at Light and Design Collective anyway. And a number of my other businesses. So, but it basically means that we start to examine and we start to empirically measure and report on all kinds of things that affect the human body within buildings. That can be things from obviously light, which we work within, and importantly air, the quality of the air inside, and measuring things like chemicals, but also things like CO2. Down to nourishment is one of the criteria, like
nourishment.
Yeah, so this would go well into what your family is into. So mm-hmm. what kind of food is available to the staff in the offices.
Oh, okay.
But also down to water. There's stringent in some of the standards, stringent criteria on water filtration into the building to make sure that it's.
So it reflects the whole building as an entity for professional workers as well, not necessarily as the building itself.
Yeah.
It's more a relation between the building itself and the human that live or work in the spaces.
Yeah, it's really very much measuring the quality of the environment from a human-centric perspective. So there's 12 or more international standards. There's some that have gained more traction than others. WELL, for example, the WELL standards and the WELL Institute from the States is very prevalent and very well used.
How did you, what is the journey that brought you to the light innovation industry? Because you studied product design,
yes.
If I'm not wrong, but you probably have a passion for architecture as well, the built environment. And so maybe that's how you combine the two, but I'm curious to know what was the journey to getting to say light is my thing,
Well, I'd love to say there was some sort of beautiful poetic story to it all that maybe was linked to my passion for photography and that I almost went and became a photographer early in my life for professional reasons, but decided not to. But it's really much more simple than that. So yes, I did start in product design, and I notably worked for IKEA in Sweden in the design department.
I've
designed a number of things there that are actually even, I think now, nearly 15 years on, are still in the stores. Right. So that's kind of...
So you designed some of the products which are still in their shelves?
Yes, that's right, yeah. So, but then I went on to get another job, actually in Denmark, as head of design for another company. And that went horribly wrong.
Okay.
And I'd already sort of... fallen slightly out of love with the monotony of product design, that it was very one-sided, that the skill set was obviously interesting, but there wasn't meant too many facets to the role itself, and I wanted to do more. I then got a job, a little bit by the fact that there wasn't too much else around in Copenhagen at the time for a lighting company. I started off doing their branding and their sort of technical side of the design. Very quickly, bit off much more than I can chew. I actually volunteered myself for a huge project that they got with Terence Conran in Copenhagen to do about four restaurants and two bars in one building. And let's just say that was my baptism of fire into lighting. And from then I loved doing it. I worked more and more, did lots and lots of projects in Scandinavia for really cool people and brands and companies, eventually got talking to my friends back here in the UK, and they suggested that the industry was booming here in terms of consultancy. I came over for a couple of days, did some interviews, got lots of jobs, and then came over here and selected a job, and the rest kind of just snowballed from there, really.
Wow, fantastic. So you went through a series of challenges with your job in your environment, if you want to say, in more north Europe, and then you decided to take all that knowledge and experience and coming back here, which the industry probably was more fertile to innovation and so on.
Yeah.
So probably that's where Krell is coming from, if you maybe. From
sure.
From an idea perspective, or tell us a little bit more about Krell, because this is the news. This is where your best of work is expressed.
Yeah. Okay. Well. So the journey that we just talked about then leapt on in terms of different opportunities I had within lighting, but pretty soon I discovered that, and I knew for a long time that. I didn't want to work really for other people. I wanted to do my own thing. And that eventually culminated in starting Lighting Design Collective's office over here in London. Grew the team. I started to spot niches and opportunities within the markets that led to, three other companies, which one is Creole, so there's now four in total, all with the common factor of light. And Creole was really a reckoning, a kind of a realization that really, what are we all doing here? Why are we doing what we're doing? And I love what I do, but I really wanted to find something with much more purpose and much more impact than the other companies. And that was the kind of the birth of the idea of Creole, which is grown.
More connected to the sustainability part, more to looking at what is the responsibilities over the planet and how to maybe also create new systems for new buildings or existing buildings to be more carbon neutral or somehow more respectful for the environment and the emissions. Because I remember for the pitching event a couple of weeks ago, you were showing some data which was very impressive, and the simple fact that carbon emissions are, I briefly studied that last year as well,
right.
About the carbon emissions of the built environment, which is a lot more than cars and other industries as well.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that, what was the There was, is there something like specific that took you in the perspective of saying I want to be more sustainable aware with my products or with my company, or was it just something that developed over time?
It was a development at the time, I think. There was always an ambition to do something impactful. I suppose at the beginning I didn't really know exactly what that impact was going to be, if I'm being completely honest. The idea started to grow of some kind of system within buildings that could allow you to be more connected to your environment and be much more, utilizing and leveraging the new kind of technologies in terms of wireless communication and direct feedback for users and much more one-to-one relationships between buildings and people. I then spread the net wide because I know very often what I want. Let's be honest, I know always what I want.
You're a designer, right?
Yeah.
So you design things as well.
Right? Yeah. But the point was, I knew what I wanted. I knew where I wanted to go at the time. But I was open to developing this. So I needed someone who could actually write the code and develop the hardware that we needed, because the way I found to do this was completely unique, and we wanted to do something that the competition wasn't doing. And that meant building something very different, using very new standards, and so on and so forth.
You needed to bridge the gap between the technologic part to develop the product.
Yeah, so imagine the analogy that I make, and I always get told off by my CTO, Joshua, because I like to oversimplify things, but it kind of helps my simple brain. But imagine you've developed some sort of software, but the computer actually doesn't exist. Imagine you've developed some kind of app and you have no form of devices. So that was kind of the situation we were in. We knew that we wanted to develop a kind of new software. We knew we needed some form of hardware. We selected a very new way of communicating wirelessly, which is developed by the Thread Group, which is a sort of sidearm of Google in terms of technology. It's very, very interesting development. But there was no hardware, so especially not for the niche and building control that we were going into. So I asked around and eventually asked my greatest partner in life, my wife, who was part of another tech startup at the time, and she asked her network. An answer came back that there was potentially this half Canadian, half Polish chap living in Canada that I should talk to. I got on Skype, thinking that I needed to find two people, someone who was a coder and someone who was good at hardware. And I came off the Skype and I realized, holy shit, I don't need two people, I need this one guy. And within 3 months, we got to know each other really well, we started working, and he moved over here with his girlfriend. And we started work, and that's sort of a little over a year ago now, and together we started to sort of pull things together from what I saw in the system, what he saw, his skill sets in environmental engineering, IoT, blockchain, stuff like that. So we really started to refine and polish, and I think it's really only in the last, 6 months or so, that the environmental angle came together in a way that it was, a bit of a no-brainer, really. It was making a lot of commercial sense, it was making a lot of impact, and it was making, it was really getting us super excited. And getting that message together was really, really complicated, but we feel it's a huge value proposition, of course.
Wow. So you mentioned something about finding this this new partner through your biggest partner, actually, which is your wife.
Yeah.
And congratulations for the news as well.
Thank you.
About you being dead soon. And my question actually is, what do you think is the role of from an entrepreneur? How important is or was your wife in this case? To develop your career and building your companies?
I think my wife is pivotal in everything I do, and hopefully vice versa. We often talk and challenge one another. We just had breakfast this morning. We almost kind of do the debrief and the rebriefing and the, you know, the talking points for what we've got to do and stuff. She's amazing. She's a support that I never knew I would have in this. And she's my biggest critic, but she's also my biggest supporter, and I couldn't ask for more. So, yeah.
So that balances you somehow between the dreams and the, like, the...
Look, I think we should all always dream, never be bound too much by reality, because if you are, then your dreams can never really be as satisfying. But of course, at some point, those dreams have to ground themselves and find their way into reality and be more pragmatic. And more than anything, if your dream is really going to become your dream, then others have to buy into that dream too. So it can't be this kind of altruistic, complicated self-journey. It's got to be something that other people resonate in and importantly understand. Communication is key in all these things.
Communication is key, absolutely. So going a little bit back, you mentioned blockchain, the product. So my question is, what do you think is the role of blockchain in the future of the built environment? And if so, do you see Krill as a major player in the in this new vision of the future, where maybe the built environment is a lot more digitalized and more easy to control? Like, something I've been reading about is like this idea of the digital twins of the buildings, which have the ability to somehow monitor and see all the sensors of the building and manage some part of it, so having this little more control on the building without necessarily being on site or something. So do you see Krill like as a major player in this this new upcoming future, where the built environment is more smart, or smart cities or smart homes?
Yeah, I do, absolutely. I just want to pick up, I totally get where you're going, technology, smart cities, all this kind of stuff. I've always had a passion for using technology in a sensible way, and so on and so forth. But I find technology, and especially smart cities and smart all this, that and the other, to be inherently misused. You know, it's so for us, it really wasn't the application of technology, because we felt that so many other people were doing, you know, application of technology into something, shoehorning technology into something. Mm-hmm. And actually, we wanted to do it the other way around. So we wanted to do, well, what are we trying to achieve, and why are we trying to achieve it? What's the most important part about what we're trying to achieve? And, you know, where blockchain really came in was about transparency. And that's really, I think, the true fundamental organizing element, and the why it will be such a critical new technology for the future, is the fact that, you know, words that are coming about mostly because of that, you know, probably people don't really understand, immutable and trustless. You know, so immutable means that it is the final and all truth. Mm-hmm. And trustless meaning that you don't have to trust me and I don't have to trust you. Now, why are those important? Well, you know, in a kind of a post-truth era that we're in, where, you know, trust is in short supply, and everything that we used to hold dear and respect, you know, is being questioned and overturned and overruled, and it seems like all the pillars of society have had question marks put next to them. What could be more important than something so critical to the whole of the planet, to everybody, as the survival of the planet and the human race, than to link it to something that is entirely truthful? To really demonstrate impact, to really have that transparency, to really be able to commit and communicate in a way where there is no trust needed. And that was the important part for us. That was the kind of the goal of joining that together with a sustainable company and technologies to make sure that, you know, whenever one of our customers makes a claim or sets a goal or does something, well, you don't have to trust them, because the system is trustless. And that's really key, because everything up until now, and you probably saw in the slide deck and actually got picked up on by a few people, it's all conjecture. You know, it's all based on best empirical science, best guesswork, if you like. Mm. There is no hard and fast data, and because of that, we don't really know. And worse off, you know, that leaves a wide open gap for people who don't believe this to then just simply say, well, it's all made up anyway. And unfortunately, they're right. You know, a lot of it is guess. It is guesswork. And we want to take the guesswork out of this big question, and we want to hold people to account, but in a way that they can, you know, achieve good things. Not, this isn't about punishment. This is actually about a value that people can really get into and actually make money out of.
Of course, and that makes completely sense. It's the first time I hear this trustless concept of blockchain, which actually makes a lot of sense because this use is basically this not need to trust the other person or the other peer in the exchange of information or money or so on. So that's probably the biggest value proposition of blockchain as a tool for new companies and technologies. But a really good point, speaking about the fact that you choose this technology simply because you want to achieve another goal. Your goal is not to necessarily use the technology, but you find that as the best way to go for. So my question now is, what do you think is the due diligence that a new entrepreneur should go for when it comes to innovation in this industry, because there is so many different tools, different technologies, so many gurus, so many there is misconception of what can be the simplest route to follow to achieve something when it comes to this industry, which I think as well in technology in general, but maybe what is your view in this specific industry?
Well, you might want to cut out this next bit for the podcast, depending on how R-rated you want this. But you know, I find there's a huge amount of technological masturbation out there. There's this kind of all these buzzwords, all these exciting spaces, and people get caught up by it. Previously it was creating something in cyberspace, and then it was creating something that was an app, and then there was something creating something that was this technology or that technology or blockchain or whatever. And I would just say that it's really not about technology at all. That's a bit like saying that,
not building for the sake of technology.
No, it's not. It's a tool. It's a vehicle. It's an enabler. And I think the sooner people understand that actually it's about the idea, it's about the goal, and then technology is the path. The technology is the way to get there. The technology is not the answer. It's the answer to the way to get there, sure. And obviously you've got to select carefully the best way to get there, both for what makes sense to you, what you're able to build, but also what ultimately is going to be the most impactful and for your message. But really, it's about the ideas, and it's about the goal. That's it.
I have one last question.
Sure.
Imagine you are going into the space, and you cannot contact anybody or anything. Do you have no?
Oh, okay.
What are the three things that you want to leave to the planet and would hope for improvement or something that you learned in your entrepreneurial journey or in your life in general? What are these three things you
want to leave
to Earth or on Earth? The main ones.
Okay. Okay. So these are things that I would hope what I implemented after I disappear or
whatever you feel that you want to leave to the Earth after you're going.
Well, I mean, obviously, Creole is kind of one of those things. I think it's a it's something that will eventually just become a self-organizing system, and that probably makes exactly no sense in the way that I say it. But hopefully, everyone will see over time what that means. That it's actually more of a it's ultimately not going to be a company as such. It's going to be more a methodology, more a way of doing things. And hopefully that impact will stay, because I can't think of anything more important than basically making sure that we have solutions that are for people and for the planet. I think there's often a bias on one or the other. So it's either, you know, it's great for people, but it's rubbish for the planet, or it's so great for the planet that actually it's compromising people in a way that don't want to change. And I actually think there is a middle ground, and there has to be a middle ground. Because otherwise it's just not going to happen. I mean, how are you going to motivate behavior if it means that you ultimately have to change everything that you do in your life? You're just not going to do it. You'll do a bit of it, you'll cherry pick, you'll try all of it. It's like, you know, getting that great new gym membership. You know, you go for the first few weeks, you're there every day, and then, you know, after a year, you probably haven't been for 6 months. And because, you know, you hit it hard, you have the best ambitions, but ultimately, it's probably not really you, right? So,
so it's about self-awareness as well, in understanding that.
It's about being humanistic, and it's about remembering that if you want people to make a change, then it has to be a change that's going to motivate them. So it has to be a change that is impactful. And again, Josh will probably leave that in the skin if he hears this. But I'll pick a phrase from my countryman, Bjarke Ingels. We talked about hedonistic sustainability, which is the idea that actually sustainability doesn't have to be something that is, you know, is bad for you and costs you money entirely, and is something that's seen as you know, almost like some kind of punishment. There can be a side of it, the hedonistic part, which actually is actually you feel better, you live better, and you prosper from being sustainable. And that's kind of what we're hoping to do with Grill. To merge, you know, the best aspects of what you want in your life with the best aspects of what is good for the planet, to merge the two together so that actually something happens. So we need to talk about one, I guess. Is that
no, but now you're actually making me think of another question, because I really like this idea of hedonistic sustainability, which we've been exploring at the university as well, with this, because we have a specific course called Sustainability and Environment Development. So, and one topic that I brought was actually that sustainability itself as a word or as a practice isn't enough, but more, and I brought more the idea of regeneration, because that's what the planet needs somehow, more than prevention itself or some more practice. So like in that case, wouldn't be this view of making everyone else feel better about the environment a way to somehow create soft spots when it comes to building products or companies, making them feel that they are doing something more sustainable, but maybe not necessarily creating that real impact. So making the term sustainability only as a medium for feeling better and access to an industry. Like, how do you manage to not fall in that trap? Because I think that even in one of my projects to university, I brought an idea and they're saying, okay, this is for sustainability and so on. But at the end of the day, I realized that it was something already built, which it wasn't necessarily part of the sustainability or new wave of sustainable approach to some planning and architectural practices. So yeah, like, how do you manage to not fall in that trap where you believe that you're doing something sustainable, but actually you're just pleasing yourself or your clients?
Well, in order to do that, you have to make sure that the impact is measurable, impact is good, and it's going to have the desired change that you're trying to do. But, you know, and I think it's important to remember that something that sounds good in your head and feels like something you might do or you might be able to achieve doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be that widespread, that other people are going to adopt it. So, you know, you have to really kick the tires on your idea. And, you know, I think the last time we had the breakfast together, you know, we talked about, you know, people being very cautious about their new ideas, not wanting to share them and stuff. And I think it's wrong.
Yeah, exactly.
I think you've got to share them. You've got to get out and talk to people, as many as people as you can, and sort of, you know, talk about your idea. Because, you know, when you're in your own little gas chamber, echo chamber, if you like, so you only get so much, you know, feedback, and actually the feedback is just you. And once you start getting an idea out and you get, you know, if the great thing to do is to present actually something to someone.
So pitch the idea.
Yeah, pitch the idea.
And get feedback.
No, but try this. So then pitch it to them and then say to them, okay, now tell me what you understood about what I just said. Yeah, and then do that a number of times and think about, okay, so they didn't say this, they didn't say that, which I thought was really like clear, but obviously it couldn't have been because they didn't mention it once. In fact, none of the people I spoke to mentioned it once. So then either is there a problem with the message or is it a problem with the idea? And you know, so this kind of validation process that you need to do and you need to be good at doing and confident at doing, because at the end of the day, no one's gonna steal your idea. I mean, no one has time. Exactly. I mean, you know, how many entrepreneurs do you truly know that are, you know, scratching out companies left, right, and center every weekend? And, you know, and so then what, you're worried about people with money doing it? People with money are no less busy than you are. In fact, they're probably, you know, insanely stretched in terms of what their commitments are to make all that money. So I think people worry too much about, you know, theft of ideas. Mm-hmm. And actually, they should be worrying more about, actually, is their idea any good? Has it actually been validated enough? So yeah, get out there, talk to people, ask them questions, get feedback. You know, be self-critical, and you know, sometimes you have to kill your ideas or change your ideas. If they just, you know, if you're hitting your head against the wall and it keeps coming back wrong, maybe it's not. It's not, you know, it's not people. It's you. It's your idea. It needs changing. It needs reshaping. It doesn't mean it's wrong. It just needs reshaping.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.